We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In this first hour of the show, we have a health topic for you, something that we have talked about from time to time in the past. We'll be talking about prostate cancer. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, so we're getting a little bit of a jump on the topic, something that we think it's good to talk about periodically. Prostate cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in men. However, there is a good news part of this. Certainly, very significant progress has been made in treating the disease. About one man in six will be diagnosed with prostate cancer, but only one in 35 will die from it. Today, there are more than 2 million men in the U.S. who have been treated at some point for prostate cancer and are still alive. So in this part of Focus, we'll try to talk a little bit about what prostate cancer is, talk about the basics, talk about screening and who should be screened, and talk about the risk factors, and then talk about some of the treatments that are available. And our guest for the program is Dr. Philippa Cheatham. She is board-certified urologist in the Department of Uro-Oncology at Columbia University Medical Center. She's also co-founder of the Society of Integrative Urology, which is an organization that's interested in advancing urologic care by incorporating research, education, and clinical practice of complementary and integrative therapies for urologic conditions, both in men and women. So as we talk, certainly questions are welcome. We invite as many questions as possible. And again, whenever we have physicians on the program, I hope people realize there are some limits as to what we can do here as the doctor can't see you. But we do programs like this to try to add to people's basic knowledge. And I'm sure that the doctor would be happy to have your question and do her best to answer it. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Toll free anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that too. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. And Dr. Cheatham, hello.
Hello. It's good to have you, and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. As I said, this is a subject that we try periodically to do because I think that there's some basic information. I'm sure you would agree there's some basic information that men really need to know and be thinking about, particularly when it comes to what's recommended for routine screening for prostate cancer.
Absolutely, and it's the number one cancer that affects men. And yet it's amazing how uneducated people are about some of the basic facts related to prostate cancer and the symptoms and how to actually go about being tested for the disease.
And it's, I think, also a point that I'm sure that you would want to make is that and while it is true that it's prostate cancer is rare in younger men, and I think it's also true that most of the time when men are diagnosed with prostate cancer, they're maybe about in the neighborhood of 70, it is important for men, and I guess here the guideline for the screening is for men about age 50 to start thinking about this.
That's correct. I mean, the American Cancer Society recommends that we begin screening for men of average risk from the age of 50 with a PSA blood test and a digital rectal examination of the prostate. That's where the doctor would examine the prostate through the rectum in the clinic. Now, that applies to men with what is called average risk, and there are certain categories of men who are at increased risk. So we know that one in six men are getting prostate cancer in the United States, and if you have a father or brother, if you have a first-degree relative with prostate cancer, that immediately increases your risk of developing the disease from 1 in 6 to 1 in 3. And the younger at which your family member is diagnosed, the younger at which we would want to screen you. So if your father was 45 or 50 when he was diagnosed with prostate cancer, we would want to screen you at a much younger age than if your father was, say, 75 or 80 when he was diagnosed. We also know that African American men have the highest risk of developing prostate cancer. So we would screen all black men at under the age of 50 and sometimes as young as 40 or even younger if they have a family member who was diagnosed at a young age with the disease.
So, and this is what we're talking about here is a routine physical exam plus involves drawing a little bit of blood. And I suppose if people are fortunate enough to have insurance and be able to see the doctor, if they're following what seems to be the standard advice and having an annual physical starting at age 50, that this simply should just be part of that.
Well, that's correct. I mean, it doesn't automatically mean that just because you're going for an annual physical that your doctor is automatically doing a prostate blood test. So the blood test we're talking about is the PSA blood test, mm-hmm. which stands for prostate-specific antigen. And this is a blood test that we do where we measure the chemical called a PSA in the blood. And the PSA is a chemical that comes from the prostate and leaks into the bloodstream. And so we would measure that level and see whether it was abnormal. If that blood level was high, then we would go on to do a biopsy of the prostate to see if we can actually find any evidence of cancer in the prostate.
I want to come back to the PSA test because there have been some questions raised about it. But before doing that, I think it would be a good idea just for me to ask you to talk a little bit about the prostate and what is the function of the prostate.
Sure. It's a great question, and it's a question that we get asked a lot in the office because most men don't really even think about what the prostate gland is or where it is or what it does until they get diagnosed with a problem, either what we call BPH, which is benign enlargement of the prostate, which can give you symptoms of poor flow, a stream that starts getting up in the middle of the night, or if you're actually diagnosed with prostate cancer. Now, let's just talk a little bit about what the prostate is and where it is. So the prostate is a tiny gland that's about the size of a walnut that sits at the base of the bladder. And so in younger men, usually the prostate causes absolutely no problems whatsoever. And the function of the prostate is to produce a fluid that nourishes sperm. So it has a function in fertility. And the prostate secretes a fluid that contributes a significant volume to the ejacula. And most of the ejacula is not composed of sperm itself. It's actually the nourishing fluids, the majority of which come from the prostate. So that's its role. And there is also an anatomical role in that the prostate that sits at the base of the bladder does give some form of valve-like mechanism to bladder control. So when the prostate starts to cause problems, it usually causes one of two problems. If the prostate gland enlarges, and the prostate gland is like a donut that encircles the urethra, which is the tube through which you empty your bladder. So if the prostate gland enlarges, it can squash into the urethra, and it can impair emptying of the bladder. So it's like squeezing a hose pipe, and it can affect the flow of urine, the drainage of the bladder. But that's more often associated with innocent enlargement of the prostate, this condition called BPH, that gives these symptoms of obstruction to urine flow, may predispose men to incomplete bladder emptying with urinary infections. It may result in them getting up at night. It may result in some issues with bladder control, some frequency and urgency. But with prostate cancer, the majority of men that we diagnosed with prostate cancer in 2011, we diagnosed them based on their blood test being abnormal and them going on to have a biopsy, and not usually based on urinary symptoms. Most of the patients I see with prostate cancer have absolutely no symptoms whatsoever. They feel well. They have no significant urinary symptoms. and they're picked up before they ever develop symptoms, which is very different to, say, 25 years ago.
Mm. Well, that's, again, that would suggest why it's important for there to be screening, particularly if you're at risk, but for all men, because if it's something that really has no symptoms, then it's something that could progress for a long way before you found out that it was there.
Well, that's right. And years ago, we used to see men when prostate cancer had spread into the bones, and they would come in with bone pain or bone fractures, and the disease was very advanced. And thankfully, we don't see men presenting like that these days. It's much more common to present, as I say, with an elevated blood test. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unfortunately, although the blood test is very useful and can help us investigate further whether somebody has prostate cancer and whether we should think about doing a biopsy, we are also detecting many, many cancers now that we would never have detected years ago. And it's some of these cancers are very low grade, but we've detected them, and so the patient knows they've got them, and then it opens up this huge can of worms about treatment options. And I do think that many men are being diagnosed with prostate cancers that have absolutely no bearing on their life expectancy whatsoever, but obviously it creates this dark cloud hanging over them. And I do believe that many men receive unnecessary treatment for prostate cancer, which in many situations can be managed with an aggressive, holistic surveillance protocol where we can address dietary factors and we can address supplements that could really keep their prostate cancer in remission.
Hmm. That, again, that's another important point, and I want to get to that. Let me, first of all, for the benefit of anybody who might have tuned in, we're talking with Dr. Philippa Cheatham. She's a board-certified urologist in the Department of Uro-Oncology at Columbia University Medical Center. We're talking about prostate cancer. September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, so we thought, well, it would be a good opportunity for us to be talking about prostate cancer. I guess it's something that men certainly need to be aware of. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just before getting back to the issue, some of the issues connected with screening and treatment, one of the things that one hears often about prostate cancer is that sort of the commonplace is that for a guy, if you live long enough, chances are you will develop it. It seems to be something that has this this age component, so that makes one wonder, well, what exactly is going on? What are the mechanisms? Do we understand, does medical science understand why prostate cancer develops?
Well, it's a great question, and you make a very important point. And I think this is a key point to emphasize, that essentially that statement that you say about if you live long enough, you're almost certainly going to develop prostate cancer comes from histological studies. These are basically post-mortem studies where they looked at men who were, say, in their 80s, 90s, and even lived longer than that, and they looked at the prostate after death of these patients who died from other causes, and they looked at the prostate microscopically. And in many, many cases, they found evidence of prostate cancer. Now, that does not mean that because they found evidence of prostate cancer on biopsying prostates after people have died from other causes, that doesn't mean that they died from the prostate cancer. And I think this is a key point to emphasize, because in a nutshell, I see men with two types of prostate cancer. And the problem is that when men are diagnosed and they're told they've got prostate cancer, they often don't know which type of prostate cancer they have. And in a nutshell, these two types of prostate cancer are the slow-growing prostate cancers that are not going to have any bearing on your life expectancy, what we call the Gleason 6. The Gleason is the grade that we use to assess the aggressiveness of prostate cancer. And these Gleason 6 prostate cancers are usually very slow-growing. They don't really progress, and they don't affect life expectancy. And for many men, we manage these on what's called a watch and wait policy, where we don't actually do any intervention like surgery or radiation. We just monitor their PSA and rectal exam every 3 months. Now, the other side of the coin are the very aggressive prostate cancers, what we call the Gleason 8s, 9s, or 10s. And these are prostate cancers that have a lot of biological activity. They're very likely to progress and to spread beyond the prostate if they're not properly treated. And these are life-threatening cancers. So the first thing that I do when a patient is diagnosed with prostate cancer is I spend some time explaining to them the type of prostate cancer they have, how aggressive it is, and then we can go on to do tests, imaging tests, to assess whether the prostate cancer is confined to the prostate, because the biopsy just tells us whether there's cancer there or not. The biopsy doesn't give us any information as to where the cancer has gone to. So a bone scan would be done to see if there's any disease in the bones, and we would usually do a CAT scan of the pelvis or an MRI of the pelvis to see if there's any spread outside the prostate into the lymph nodes in the pelvis or the glands that sit on top of the prostate, what's called the seminal vesicles. So it's very important at diagnosis to ascertain how aggressive the cancer is and where the cancer has spread to before we can even start discussing the numerous treatment options that are available today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a caller I'm going to get right to. Just as a very quick follow-up, I just want to make certain that the determination of a cancer on the Gleason scale, is that something that's relatively easy and straightforward to do? That is, you should, without a lot of questions, you as a physician should be able to make that.
So the Gleason grade is determined by the pathologist. So once the urologist has taken a biopsy of the prostate, they look at the tissue under the microscope. They look at the cores that we take from the biopsy. And they look under the microscope and they grade the cells according to the aggressiveness, and they have certain characteristics. So the lower the grade, the more likely those cells look like normal prostate cells. The more aggressive the disease, the more likely those cells have lost features that look like normal prostate cells. So they can look at the nucleus of these cancer cells, and there's various cellular characteristics that they can use. But there is some objective interpretation. So different pathologists can call different samples different grades. So it's quite important that the pathologist who's reporting is somebody who's trained at reporting on prostate cancers, and they have a specialty interest in that. And there are newer tests now which look at other molecular markers, but the Gleason score is a microscopic grading of the cancer.
All right, we have a caller here to talk with. They're in Urbana, and we'll talk with them right now on line one.
Yes. Here is my question. If you have been identified as having prostate cancer, and if you have a Gleason score of 6, then my understanding is that there's absolutely no way to tell definitively how aggressive that cancer might progress, so that watchful waiting is like playing Russian roulette. What do you think of that?
Well, there's a couple of things to say about that. The way we would manage a Gleason 6 would also depend on the age of the patient. So a Gleason 6 in a 45-year-old is a very different situation to a Gleason 6 in a 75-year-old, because there is a chance that a Gleason 6 may morph into a more aggressive form. So if we are going to manage a Gleason 6 prostate cancer, the ideal patient to manage on a watch and wait policy, what we call active surveillance, is somebody who's older. Now, in answer to your question about how you tell the aggressive potential, the Gleason score gives us some information, but what we're using more and more is a molecular test called the Orion test. And what this test involves, it's a test that looks at molecular markers on the prostate cancer cells. And we particularly look at receptors called the androgen receptors. And the androgen receptors are proteins on prostate cancer cells to which the hormone testosterone binds to. And this Orion test allows us to get a score to determine whether a Gleason 6 is a favorable Gleason 6 or a less favorable Gleason 6. And so if you had had a biopsy done by your urologist and it's reported as a Gleason 6, then you can actually have your slides of your biopsy sent to Orion, and they can do this molecular test, which gives extra information about the potential aggressiveness of your disease.
My further question is, how definitive is that?
Active surveillance, the key really is to manage you as time moves on. So, for example, if you have a biopsy that shows a Gleason 6 in 2011, then we wouldn't just monitor you for 5 years with a blood test and not actually re-biopsy you, because in 5 years' time, we'd be managing you on old data from your biopsy in 2011. So the key, really, if you're on an active surveillance policy, is to have a regular PSA every 3 months, a digital rectal examination every 3 months. The Orion score can give some extra information, and we would normally recommend that you have a repeat biopsy approximately 6 to 12 months down the road to check that the amount of Gleason 6 has not changed, and also to check that the grade of the cancer has not changed, because if you have Gleason 6 that involves all the cores that have been biopsied, although your cancer is low aggressiveness, you have quite a large volume, and that's a very different situation to somebody who has a 12-core biopsy where only one out of 12 cores has Gleason 6 cancer, and that may only involve a tiny percentage of that core. It may be less than 5%. So there are a lot of variables, a lot of factors that come into assessing whether or not a patient is suitable for active surveillance. Can I ask how old you are?
Yeah. Well, I was 70 when I was diagnosed with prostate cancer, and I had a very good doctor, and I was told that watchful waiting was playing Russian roulette. I'll be 87 next month. My cancer seems to be gone. That was 17 years, and I think I made a good decision to have a radical prostatectomy. I didn't have to worry all those years.
Well, the thing is that, you know, also there have been changes in the reporting of Gleason scores in the last 17 years. So we are picking up cancers much earlier. But generally, most people who are Gleason 6 at 70, you know, the treatment options are not without risks. And many patients have issues with the side effects of treatment. And these patients who have very low-grade, low-volume prostate cancer that's low-risk, it's not really any more a question of whether we could cure them. It's more a question of the legacy of the side effects of the treatment options they choose. And generally, if you're properly monitored and you're a Gleason 6, then it's very unusual for somebody to jump from, say, a Gleason 6 to a Gleason 9 and has missed the window to treat people. So we are using other information to help guide us. So in my patients who we have on an active surveillance policy, we would also do an MRI of the prostate to make sure there's no evidence of the cancer invading the capsule of the prostate, to make sure there's no other abnormalities. And there are other gene tests that we can use, urine gene tests called PCA3 urine tests, that can give us extra information. But you've done extremely well, and that's great news to hear that you remain in remission 17 years later.
Yeah, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. We're talking this morning with Dr. Philippa Cheatham. She is board-certified urologist in the Department of Uro-Oncology at Columbia University Medical Center. We're talking about prostate cancer, and basic questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, this really gets into what is the difficult area here, and that is if we're going to be screening a lot of men, we're going to be picking up cancers that in the past we would not have, and chances are we probably also will be identifying cancer in younger men who are young. If we're going to start doing a lot of screening at 50, we're going to start picking up cancers in younger men and cancers that are not far developed. So, Dr. Cheatham?
Yes, oh. I mean, I think that there's some issues here, and I think that prostate cancer raises so many controversial subjects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for example, we've talked about all these screen-detected prostate cancers, and, you know, that's one side of the coin, and that often it creates this worried well.
Yeah.
But the other side of the coin is the Western diet is horrific, and there are so many things in the Western diet that drive prostate cancer cell growth. And although we are detecting more cancers as a result of screening, we are seeing prostate cancer in younger and younger men. And we are these prostate cancers, I mean, I've seen two patients in the last month who were diagnosed with prostate cancer in their 30s. And these were not insignificant cancers. These were aggressive cancers that are life-threatening. And I do think that not only do we have to think about early detection, but we also have an obligation to think about strategies for prostate cancer prevention.
Mm.
And one of the things that I'm very passionate about is educating men who are at high risk or who've been diagnosed with prostate cancer, who have sons who are at increased risk, that we really educate the population about the foods which are likely to drive prostate cancer. And there are many foods in the diet that can actually protect against prostate cancer, but this is so rarely ever discussed with patients, even when they're diagnosed.
Yeah. Well, this, I'm sure this is something people would like to hear about. There's a great deal of interest now in prevention of disease, for one thing, and in things that people can do in their lifestyle to be more healthy and reduce their possibility of developing disease. And this also gets back to my earlier question about, well, do we really know what's going on here, what causes it? So give us your list of recommended things and your list of things that you would say try to minimize these things in your life.
Okay. So, I mean, essentially, I see men in three different categories. I see men that have been diagnosed with prostate cancer who want to go on an active surveillance protocol as opposed to having surgery or radiation. That's one group of men. I see those men who've been biopsied who have precancerous changes in their prostate but have not yet developed full-blown cancer and really want to address dietary changes to prevent the development of the disease. And I also see many men who have prostate cancer who've been treated with surgery or radiation and may have a recurrence of the disease on the PSA, and they want to really address the dietary changes to prevent progression of the disease that's already been treated. So the information that I give to my patients, first thing to say, and probably one of the most powerful things to say regarding diet, is that there are more than 25 studies that show that the more red meat that you eat, the more likely you are to develop prostate cancer. And there is so much evidence in the medical literature that supports that red meat is bad news for prostate cancer. And there are a number of reasons for this. Red meat contains a lot of harmful, what's called carcinogens. These are chemicals that convert normal cells into cancer cells. So red meat contains a lot of what's called heterocyclic amines that drive prostate cancer. We also know that if you barbecue meat or you cook meat so it's well done, it releases more dangerous, harmful chemicals called polyhydrocarbons that are prostate cancer promoting. We also know that a lot of cured meats contain nitrites. So I tell all my patients with prostate cancer to eliminate red meat completely from the diet. We also know that if you have a diet that contains a lot of animal fat, saturated fat, processed food, fried foods, all of these things they're not only bad for your cardiac health, but they're also very bad for your prostate health. We know that men in Japan have the lowest risk of prostate cancer than anywhere else in the world. We also know that if you take men from Japan and they move to America, their risk of prostate cancer increases dramatically. Now, obviously, their genes don't change, but their environmental risk factors really do. So the more your diet is like a Western diet, as opposed to the Japanese diet that's very rich in fish, they eat a lot of plant foods, that you know, it's not coincidence that the risk of prostate cancer is extremely low in Japan, and yet it's the highest incidence in the world in America. We know that Japanese men take a lot of Japanese green tea, and green tea is a powerful antioxidant that can protect against prostate cancer. There are so many foods in the diet that have been shown to be prostate cancer protective. So all the green leafy vegetables, what we call the cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, kale, spinach, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, these vegetables are very rich in isoflurane that protect against prostate cancer. There's an ingredient in tomatoes called lycopene that can protect against prostate cancer. And we know that the purple fruits, like pomegranate, berries, black currants, these contain other powerful antioxidants that can mop up the free radicals, which are the dangerous chemicals that can drive the conversion of normal cells to cancer cells.
We're talking this morning about prostate cancer. Our guest is Dr. Philippa Cheatham from the Columbia University Medical Center. I have a caller who we'll get right to in a moment. First, though, we need to take a quick break. This is Focus.
In 2003, peaceful unarmed women took on warlords and the regime of dictator Charles Taylor, winning peace for their shattered country, Liberia. Our next community cinema screening, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, tells the story of these freedom fighters. The free public screening is at the main Champaign Public Library, Tuesday, September 6th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. The film's closed captioned and the discussion translated by a sign language interpreter.
Programs on WILL are made possible by the Illinois Professional Science Master's programs on the Urbana-Champaign campus, offering graduate degrees that combine science and business, including the program in plant biology. More information is available at 217-265-5363 or on the web at psm.illinois.edu.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you here. We're here weekday mornings 10 until noon, 10 different topics. In hour number two today, we'll be talking with author William Adler, who's written a biography of Joe Hill, a man who certainly is an icon of American labor. I think perhaps there'll be a lot of people who will recognize the name but really not know the story, and we will tell the story. And that's the story William Adler tells in his new book, The Man Who Never Died. We're here weekday mornings, as I say, 10 to noon. You can get the schedule by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. You can also listen to past programs that way as well. In this hour of Focus, we are talking about prostate cancer. It's almost September, and September is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. We thought it would be good to try to cover the basics on this issue once again. And our guest is Dr. Philippa Cheatham. She is a board-certified urologist in the Department of Uro-Oncology at Columbia University Medical Center. If you have a question, give us a call, 333-9455. That's the local number. We also have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. And we'll also take email at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go back to the phones here, and our next caller is in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
13 years ago, I had a radical prostatectomy, and it was evaluated to be a Gleason 6. I had no evident spread to lymph nodes, seminal vesicles, or anything else. And for about a year or two, my PSA was zero, as could be expected. It was a very small tumor. I think it was several millimeters in diameter only. About 3 years post-operative, my PSA appeared again and began to rise slowly. And over the years, it reached, I think, 1.7. Well, I started taking dietary supplements, specifically soy isoflavones, selenium, and green tea, at which time my PSA plateaued and has remained plateaued for quite a while, and recently has begun to go down, and then now it's 1.2. I don't know that these dietary supplements are the cause of that regression. Another possibility is that perhaps I've developed some kind of immunity against that cancer over the years. Is that a possibility?
So really, really great questions there. I see a lot of men like you who've had surgery, and then months or years down the line, their PSA goes from being undetectable, which is what we would expect after removal of the prostate, the operation that you had, the open radical prostatectomy, and then the PSA starts to rise. And essentially, there's three reasons why the PSA may be detectable months or years after surgery. One is there may be microscopic cells that are left behind that are innocent prostate cells, but they will still express the PSA. So over many years, the PSA may slowly start to rise. But this is not recurrence of cancer. This is innocent cells of the prostate that the surgeon can't see that get left behind and that over many years later will start to express the PSA. The second reason may be local recurrence in what we call the prostate bed. So this is cancer recurrence, but just locally within the pelvis. And the third reason is when you have distant spread outside the prostate area, where there may be microscopic prostate cancer cells that have spread to the bone, for example, or the lymph nodes. So when we see somebody like you, we base our management on what we call PSA doubling time. So how quickly your PSA doubles. If you come to see me and your PSA is 0.3, then what I would want to know is how quickly does it take for your PSA to reach 0.6 and then to double to 1.2 and 2.4 and so on. And I work very closely with an oncologist, Daniel Petrelak, at Columbia University Medical Center. And we see patients together in a joint urology-oncology clinic. And we always get concerned when we see a man whose PSA is doubling within 6 months. That means if the PSA is doubling within 6 months, the speed of the PSA is quite rapid. So in your situation, your PSA is actually not doubling at all, which is great news. Your PSA has actually gone down, which would indicate to me that the most likely explanation is the former, where you may have just had microscopic cells left behind that are expressing the PSA. What we want to try and do with somebody like you is slow down the doubling time, especially in people who may have a PSA that's doubling because of recurrent disease. And you've mentioned some good things already. The green tea is fantastic. Many patients I see are deficient in vitamin D, and we know that if you're deficient in vitamin D, there are some studies that suggest you are more likely to progress with prostate cancer. So I would advise you to get your vitamin D level measured and, if necessary, take some vitamin D supplements. And I have all my patients on 5,000 international units. And you can also boost your immune system with an immune enhancer called AHCC, which is derived from the roots of a Japanese mushroom, the subspecies of the shiitake mushroom, that can really boost your immune system naturally. And there's more than 25 published studies to support the role of AHCC in boosting your immune system and reducing the risk of prostate cancer progression.
Thank you very much. That sounds quite reasonable.
All right. Well,
and I mean, I would be very reassured with your PSA. I would not rush into starting hormones. There's no evidence whatsoever that you would benefit from hormonal therapy. And actually, you would not welcome the side effects related to hormones. So cut out the red meat, eat plenty of green leafy vegetables, add in the AHCC, get your vitamin D level checked, take 5,000 international units a day, and sit tight, because I really don't think you have anything to worry about at all.
Well, I just turned 81, so, you know, I don't have a long way to go.
Well, I mean, I see many patients who are in their 90s and beyond who are doing very, very well. So stay positive, stay strong, and keep on a healthy diet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. We have about maybe 12 minutes left in this part of Focus. Again, we're talking about prostate cancer. Our guest is Dr. Philippa Cheatham. She's a urologist in the Department of Uro-Oncology at Columbia University Medical Center. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, as people I think will appreciate, once you make a diagnosis, and then you start talking about possible treatment, then it starts to become pretty complicated because you have to try to determine what sort of cancer this is, how aggressive it is, has it spread outside the prostate. You have to take into consideration, I'm sure, a number of factors, including the age of the patient. So for each man, it's going to be an individual thing. Having said all that, though, once you get to the point of thinking about treatment, there are a number of options that include radiation, that include some kind of surgery, including the complete removal of the prostate, which, as you mentioned, which brings with it some possibility of some rather undesirable side effects. How do you talk with men about what sort of treatment might be appropriate for them?
Sure. So a lot of patients that I see come to me for a second opinion, and they've already seen their own local urologist who may have done the biopsy. They may have been to see a surgeon and discussed either open or robotic prostatectomy. They may have been to see a radiation oncologist and discussed the different radiation treatments. And, you know, most of the guys that I see are extremely overwhelmed. They have so much literature on the different treatment options, and they're just very confused, and they simply don't know what to do. The most important point, I think, is that for the majority of patients, there is no urgency. You don't need to panic and rush into a treatment option. And even for the most aggressive prostate cancers, you have, you know, a good 8 to 12 weeks to really look and explore your treatment options. And those are for the aggressive cancers. And for the less aggressive cancers, the Gleason 6 and Gleason 7, you've got several months, if not longer, to really explore your treatment options. So I would urge anyone who's listening who's been diagnosed with prostate cancer or who has a family member who's just been diagnosed, don't panic. Take your time to really understand what your treatment options are. Don't be frightened to get a second opinion and really understand what your pathology means. Get your doctor to explain to you what your Gleason score is, how many cores of your prostate biopsy are involved with cancer. Get them to explain to you what the MRI shows, what the CAT scan shows. And the problem in America in particular is that most surgeons specialize in one particular area. And this adds to the confusion for many patients because you go and see a surgeon and they're going to talk to you about surgery. You go and see a radiation oncologist, they're going to talk to you about their particular treatment option in radiation, whether it be external beam, whether it be CyberKnife, whether it be proton beam. And so each specialist is saying, look, my treatment is the best option for you. And that's why patients get so confused. So, I mean, I've actually written two books for patients to try and allay some of the controversies about treatment options. I've written a book called Robotic Prostatectomy, Is It For You?, that takes patients through before, during, and after the surgery. And I've also written a book on cryotherapy, which is very rarely offered to patients. This is freezing of the prostate, which is a treatment that can work extremely well, both in men who have a new diagnosis of cancer and also men who have recurrent cancer following radiation where their cancer has come back. And what we're trying to do now is treat men as minimally invasively as possible. And it is possible now to just treat the side of the prostate that's affected and not necessarily treat the whole gland, especially if the cancer is localized and it's a lower grade cancer. So we can actually reduce many of the side effects by offering these minimally invasive treatments. But My most important message really is don't panic. Don't be pressurized by anybody into picking a treatment option until you're really comfortable that you've fully explored all the treatment options out there.
Mm-hmm. What I'm sure that is, it's for a lot of difficult, what's difficult for a lot of men is if you get the diagnosis of prostate cancer, they say, okay, there's a cancer in your prostate, then, and again, I suppose this would depend a lot on what age man we're talking about here, though. I think that there might be a lot of guys who would just right away say, okay, get it out of there.
There are a lot of men who say that, but yeah. I see far more men who come and say the opposite, and they say, look, I want to avoid surgery and radiation and the debilitating side effects. Can I manage my prostate cancer by making dietary changes? And for many of those men, we really can. And those men who are appropriate for active surveillance with dietary intervention and immune supplementation, these are some of the happiest patients I've got, because their prostate cancer goes into remission. They go on the diet, they lose the weight, they lose the belly, they feel more energized, and they avoid the side effects of radiation and surgery. That's not to say that all men with prostate cancer are suitable for a pure active surveillance / holistic approach. And that's why it's key to understand the type of prostate cancer that you have.
Mm. Just to talk a little bit more about surgery, I'm sure that men have heard and would have concerns about the surgery that involves removal of the prostate. There have been problems in the past with this surgery and resulting, I think the issue was resulting nerve damage in that area that can lead to two very troubling symptoms, urinary incontinence and impotence. Have there been improvements made in these surgeries so that those side effects, which no guy is going to want it to deal with if he could help it, end up minimized?
Yes, there's been huge advances in prostate cancer surgery in the last 10 years. We now have the Da Vinci robot, so we can do robotic prostatectomy, which avoids the need to do a major open abdominal incision. It means that the recovery following surgery is much quicker. The risk of needing blood transfusions is almost non-existent now with robotic surgery. But the key is, it's not about the robot. It's about the surgeon that's controlling the robot. So if you're going to have prostate cancer surgery, whether it be open surgery, whether it be keyhole laparoscopic surgery, or whether it's robotic surgery, the key is to go to a surgeon who has a high volume experience. So some surgeons are doing robotic prostatectomies and they're doing less than 50 cases a year. I know surgeons that have done nearly 5,000 robotic prostatectomies. And obviously, the more cases that you do, the better your results are going to be. So patients often say to me, well, is robotic surgery better than open? But it's also important to remember in whose hands you're talking about. And that applies to any procedure. The more experience a unit has and the more experience an individual surgeon has, the better the results. We do know that there are issues with urinary control after surgery, and the younger you are, the fitter you are, and the lower your urine symptom score before surgery, the better the outcome. But I can tell you, based on our own data at Columbia University, that 92% of our patients regain their continence completely and are fully dry, and 50% of those patients would be completely dry at 6 weeks. So we teach men pelvic floor exercises, and we now do what's called a nerve-sparing procedure, where we try and protect the nerves that supply sexual function. And we also have a very aggressive protocol to rehabilitate men after surgery, where we can address issues of sexual function with the assistance of medication and other treatment options to really help them get their sexual function back as quickly as possible. Mm. It's very important to go to a surgeon who offers the full package. It's not just about the surgery on the day. It's about the full rehabilitation package that goes with that.
We have a couple of minutes, and I have another caller here that we'll get to in Ogden on our line number one. Hello.
Have a PSA that hangs around 3 at the yearly checkup, and we do a biopsy every year and nothing shows up. Is this something I have to keep doing every year? Or
how old are you, sir?
54.
Okay. So a PSA of 3, many men will know that a PSA of less than 4 is considered normal. However, there are age-specific ranges for the PSA. So in your 50s, a PSA that's over 2.5 would be considered abnormal. So that would probably explain why you've had these biopsies. One of the things that we're interested in is not just what the PSA reading is, but what the rate of change is. If you say that your PSA is hovering around 3, and it's not really changing year on year, that's far less concerning to me than a gentleman whose PSA is 0.8 one year and then 12 months later it's 2.5. So if your PSA is not really changing, then I would be less concerned. I would also want to know what your prostate felt like on rectal exam, because if you have an enlarged prostate but it feels innocently enlarged, then that prostate will kick out more PSA into your bloodstream than, say, a gentleman who has a prostate gland that's half the size. Now, that doesn't mean that you're at increased risk of prostate cancer. It just means that if you have a bigger size gland that's innocently enlarged, then there'll be more PSA in the bloodstream. And that may explain why your PSA is slightly elevated for your age, but why it's not really going up significantly. So obviously you need to be kept a close eye on. And I would recommend maybe there are special MRI-guided biopsies. I would recommend doing the urine PCA3 gene test as well. And if there was any concern, it may be useful to actually find out what the prostate looks like on imaging, maybe with an MRI scan.
Okay, that sounds reasonable.
I would ask your doctor if you can have what's called a urine PCA3 test. This is a urine test that your doctor can do after they've examined the prostate. So the prostate cells are massaged out of the prostate, and then after you've had a prostate exam, you urinate into a cup, and then we can send that urine for a very special test called a PCA3 gene test, which is something that we're using in the office more and more to avoid men having to have repeat biopsies when there's not much going on with the PSA. And so you'd be the perfect candidate for that kind of test. Hmm.
I need to jump in here. I'm sorry to jump in on the caller, but we're simply going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. I'd like to say thanks to our guest, Dr. Philippa Cheatham. She's a board-certified urologist in the Department of Uro-Oncology at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Cheatham, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Pleasure. It's been an absolute honor. Thank you for having me. Urinate into a cup, and then we can send that urine for a very special test called a PCA3 gene test, which is something that we're using in the office more and more to avoid men having to have repeat biopsies when there's not much going on with the PSA. And so you'd be the perfect candidate for that kind of test. Hmm.
I need to jump in here. I'm sorry to jump in on the caller, but we're simply going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. I'd like to say thanks to our guest, Dr. Philippa Cheatham. She's a board-certified urologist in the Department of Uro-Oncology at Columbia University Medical Center. Dr. Cheatham, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Pleasure. It's been an absolute honor. Thank you for having me.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're midway through here. Coming up in the next part of the show, we'll be talking with William Adler. He is the author of a new book. The title of the book is The Man Who Never Died, The Lifetimes and Legacy of Joe Hill, American Labor Icon. And we'll get the story. I think, as I said a little earlier, a lot of people know that name but don't really know the story of Joe Hill. And Bill Adler tells it in the book, and it's quite an interesting story as well. So that's coming up in the next part of Focus. We'll take our usual break here for an update on the commodity markets and some news. We'll be back. Stay tuned.
Agricultural information on WILL is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Before we get rolling too far, a quick reminder that Todd Gleason is out at the Farm Progress Show in the University of Illinois tent from the main entrance there on West Prospect Street, Progress Street. Just make a right and walk down the block until you see the U of I tent. You'll have an agricultural marketing panel at 3, but before that, you'll have a live broadcast of the closing market report. Come on in and sit on down, and we have a lot of special guests online this afternoon for you. That's Todd Gleason at the U of I tent at the Farm Progress Show. Let's go ahead and look at particulars in Kansas City. September wheat now trading 866 and a quarter, down 1 1/4. March at $9.75, down 3 1/4. September wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade is at 7.38 3/4, down 11 1/2. December, 7.88 1/2, down 2 1/4. March of next year, 8.25, unchanged. September corn's at 7.62 1/2, down 1. December, 7.73 1/4, down 2. March, 7.85, down 2 1/4. May, 7.88 3/4, down 2 1/4. July, 7.91 3/4, down 2 1/4. September soybeans are at 14.49 1/4, up 1/2. November, 14.61, up 4. January, 14.71, up 4 3/4. March, 14.72 1/4, up 6 1/2. May, 14.65 1/2, up 6 1/4. July soybeans at 14.68, up